Brahmin male was not for Brahmin female, or what was right for Brahmin male, like mediating with a divine or reading scripture, was not appropriate for a lower caste person. And so morality was a matter of where you were born. And the Buddha came around and said, well, that's stupid. You know, like, he actually apparently talked like that. You know, he'd say to people, you fool. he'd say, well, that's stupid. You know, morality is based in the intention behind an action. If you do an action out of greed or hatred, it has consequences. It doesn't matter whether you're male or female. It doesn't matter whether you're high caste or low caste. You know, that's the place to look. And so that was pretty revolutionary. Based on. The most accurate description for our time is that sense of codependence, as we reflect on those phrases, all beings are the owners of their karma. You know, so it's not that easy to use in impersonal situations. It's much easier to use with your friend who drinks too much and, you know, see where it could fit perfectly. And then if it's going to make you uneasy, you probably have to change the words. Just change the words. It's fine. Because you know the feeling. Like, I will do everything and, you know, I may not see the resolution of this. Or, as far as I can tell, the people who are the most effective in the long haul are the people with an unfathomable sense of vision and patience. You know, like, I think of the civil rights movement in this country, and I realized I was also a victim of kind of the tyranny of history or time, because I was a little young to be marching and so on, but people I knew left college and marched and so on and got beaten up. And I look back and I think, what an amazing thing, like the people who, because I'm so into voting, you know, people went out and did voter registration and freedom riders and so on, and knowing that to get the job done, they needed to put their lives at risk, and they went and did it. And then I realized, like, they didn't even know it was going to get the job done. They just knew they had to do it. It's like we look back and we say, oh, look what it took for people to do, knowing it was going to work, and they didn't know it was going to work, because we never do. Right, going forward. So it's something of that sense, too, with equanimity. It's like, no one's written me a guarantee, you know, that this is going to be the most effective thing or the thing that's going to make a difference, but it's the thing I've got to do. And so we, in a way, let go of the immediacy of results. And I've just seen that in others, you know, again and again and again. It seems to be a pretty important ingredient, because in the end, you know, we look back often, I think, and when we're lucky, and we see, oh, look at that, that had a place. You know, I couldn't tell at the time that it was really the right thing, but it did. It did have a place. That's my 13th book, is Karma. Yes. yes. Joel, hear that? Okay, the question was about the dying process, and is the kind of stuff we're learning here with equanimity and so on, will it make that process less suffering? I hope so. I think so, but I said that because I was once, just through some circumstances, I was in this very small gathering with the Dalai Lama and some people. And one of my friends was there who's extremely phobic about dying, frightened. And she wasn't near death, but it's something she thought about anyway, all the time. And he was telling her about the Buddhist practice of just reflecting on death every day. And she said, do you think that's going to help you when the time comes? And he said, I hope so. So if he's going to say that, I'm going to say that. Yes, of course, you know, like, a really tremendous book to read is Frank Ostasevsky's book, Five Invitations or something like that. Is that what it's called? And he's a great, great guy. And he's one of the founders of the San Francisco Zen Hospice. And he's worked a lot with people who are dying, you know. And so he would also say, don't have expectations, you know. But it makes sense. It's like when I just saw my friend who's dying, who, you know, was an incredibly generous, kind person, and for her to lie there and say, I'm content. It was really beautiful. And to see the people she was in, this great hospice place, and, you know, how amazing the people were, and I just thought, oh, yeah, there's some karma, you know, it's like that's getting fulfilled. So she's kind of dying the way she lived. So, yeah. But I'll go back to the Dalai Lama and say I hope so as well. Okay, why don't we take a break, come back, and we'll finish. 20 minutes? Because I think it's too hot to walk. That's what I'm... Yeah. Ooh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Hello. Okay, so I want to speak some, we'll sit some, we'll be done. And then I'm going to go to the back, I'm told, to sign some books. So if anyone just wants to say hello and goodbye again, even without a book, that's fine. So somebody just asked me a question, which I think connects to some larger questions. And that was a story I told in, I guess it's in Real Love, about that ever so famous course with Sayadaw Pandita in 1984, when we brought him to Barry. So remember the circumstances. I'd never met him before. He showed up one day and began teaching the next. He's the only person I spoke to for 3 months. He was a Burmese monk, very severe, very intense, very demanding. So the other part of the story is that I had a friend who died not that long before the retreat. And we were seeing Upandita for these little meetings 6 days a week, just to, you would describe your practice and then he would give you some feedback. So I felt a lot of reluctance to talk to him about my friend. I mean, I didn't really know him, and it was sort of odd. But it was very prevalent in my mind and how sad I felt about him dying. So I finally told him, and he said, Upandita said, are you very sad? And I said, yes. And he said, are you crying? And I thought, oh, damn. You know, now I have to tell him I'm crying. So I said, just a little bit. And he kind of shook his head dolefully at me, and he said, every time you cry, you should cry your heart out. He said, that way you'll get the best release. And you could have knocked me over. I was like, wow. And 4 days later, he was saying something different. Because it's all about balance, right? And before, I had been like sort of withholding, and I didn't want to really feel what I was feeling, and I was like, trying to hold it down or something, and then I let loose, and then he had something else to say, you know. And the comment, the person who brought me the story, reminded me of the story, was saying how hard it is to find balance, and it is hard to find balance. So I wouldn't look for perfection there either, but just to understand that's important, and that it's what we're going for. We're not going just to suffer. For example, Buddhism intrigued me right away is a system of thought, because suffering itself is not redemptive. You know, we are not ennobled by suffering, necessarily. We might be, but it's not the suffering, it's the way we relate to the suffering. And there's certainly plenty of people on this earth who suffer everything from slightly to in a major way, who just seem isolated and bitter and angry, and they don't seem that ennobled by it. And yet, there are people even with, you know, terrible life circumstance who do seem to have a tremendous compassion and a sense of connection. And that, more than anything, is inspiring to me, because I think it's like when you're in physical pain, the move is inward. You know, it's like you feel, it's like a magnet. And to pay attention to anybody else is not easy. And the same, certainly, with emotional pain. You know, the move is kind of to huddle in and not, and to be cut off. And certainly to feel isolated in some way, like it's only me. And to remember connection, community, caring about others, even listening to others in those circumstances is a pretty major thing. And I've seen people do it, you know, in an extraordinary way. And their compassion is just like really shining forth. And, you know, and so the point is not just to suffer endlessly. If you're exhausted, it's like him, you know, in that other story where he said, move your attention to something that's easier. It's how we're with the suffering that's the point, not just the fact that we suffer. And some people will sit, for example, trying not to move physically in practice, and they'll be hating every moment of their experience, you know, and just like sitting there uptight and hateful. And it's sort of, that's a shame, you know, like, you don't have to do that. Because the point is, how are we with it? And that doesn't mean perfectly, you know, every moment, but can you get interested in your experience, even for a few minutes? Can you pay attention? Can you have compassion for yourself instead of so much judgment? Can this be leading to a greater connection with others rather than a sense of isolation? That's sort of more the point. And that comes out of a balanced relationship. So sometimes balance looks like get up and take a walk, you know, or take a nap. Sometimes it looks like, you know, you're so half-hearted, maybe you could really get here a little more. And we're the ultimate monitor, not anyone else. And like I said earlier, I don't want you like sitting there constantly thinking, you know, am I trying too hard? Am I trying hard enough? But sometimes that intuition arises, like, oh, I'm so far back. It's like, I couldn't care less what a breath feels like. That's a clue. You know, or you're saying, may you be happy, as though you're saying, you need to empty the trash. You know, that's a clue too. Or you're so uptight, and it's like, I only have a few hours. And that's a clue also, you know. So when we get those clues, we can respond. And it's all about some balance. So do you cry? Maybe you cry. The idea is of insight meditation is a non-interfering awareness. That means something comes up really strongly, you don't try to squash it down, and you also don't necessarily just have it be overwhelming and dictating your choices and taking over. Like, this is the only thing I'll ever feel, right? So we're always slicing down that place in the middle. And that means practice. Because it's not going to come automatically to us. It's just not. And so we practice and we practice and we practice. My friend Bob Thurman, he doesn't like the word practice. So sometimes when we teach together, he's on me about that. And he says, practice, practice, practice. When's the performance? But it's all kind of performance. It's not practice in the sense of incomplete or insufficient. It really is like strength training, and there's no other way. It's like the process of meditation is not one where it's not like getting a conscript in the Civil War or something, like someone else is going to do it for us. You know, it doesn't work that way. And it's not like carrying around your yoga mat is actually going to have you accomplished in yoga. It's something else that has to happen, unfortunately. You know, you can write 15, 20, 30 books on meditation. Doesn't mean you actually practice. And there's something very humbling about practice, which is very important too. It's like taking what we value as an abstract. It's very important to be in the present moment and making it real. You know, so I just wanted to tell the story. I went to India as a junior in college. And I'd taken a course in Asian philosophy, which was really a course in Buddhism. And I would have said, yeah, I really understand this stuff. You know, I did a term paper on something. And I had all my midterm exams on karma or something like that, you know. And then my first teacher was Goenka. I know some of you have probably sat with him, and there's a certain pattern to his discourses. He was always giving the same discourses through all those years of teaching. And there's a kind of essential teaching in Buddhism. I kind of referred to it earlier on when I talked about the six sense doors and pleasure, pain, or neutrality, and how we react to that feeling tone, which is called the Wheel of Dependent Origination, which is a very, very complex teaching. That's a vast oversimplification of it. It's really a teaching about how the whole world can arise without any solidity, without there being a solid, unchanging self. But the really crucial practical element is contact, feeling, craving. It's the feeling tone of pleasantness, unpleasantness, neutrality, and how we respond to it, how we react to it. So I would sit there in a lot of physical pain for a number of reasons, some psychological, some just, you know, like we didn't have any zafus, we didn't have any zabutons, we didn't have any chairs. We used to like roll up our sleeping bags and just sit on the concrete floor. And it hurt. So I forget which day it was. There's some night that Goenka would talk about dependent origination. And it would all be, you know, relating to pleasure differently, relating to pain differently, relating to neutrality differently. And my inner dialogue was something like, I'd hear him talk and I think, oh, that is so inspiring. I'm so glad I came to India. It's such an amazing presentation. If only I could get rid of this knee pain, I'm sure I could go far in the practice. And he would go on, and I would go on, and I think, maybe I'll go to that yoga ashram I heard about in South India, and I'll do like 6 months of yoga, and then I'll come back, and I won't have any knee pain. I can get enlightened right away. And then he would go on, and I would go on, he would go on, and I would go on. It took a really long time to realize what he was talking about and what the Buddha had been talking about was my knee pain. This is the present moment's experience, a physical sensation. It was very painful. How was I with it? Right? It's right there. It's not in another experience or a deferred experience. When I was on tour, on book tour with Real Happiness, which was a book I wrote that has a lot of guided meditations in it. It's about really how to start or renew a meditation practice. So many people would come up to me and say, would you sign this book for my cousin? They'll really get a lot out of it. I could never meditate myself. But and I think, well, nice for me in that you're buying my book, and nice for your cousin, but what's this like, it's all about them, it's not about me thing, right? So we do many things to not put it into practice. And I actually end Real Happiness with saying something like, it seems so ironic to me that if really any one of us likely were told, here's this thing you can do 20 minutes a day, it'll really help your friend, we do it. It'll really help you, oh, I can't do that. I have so much to do, and there's so many other people, and you know, I have to take care of them, and like, really? 20 minutes a day? So it's a kind of boldness, actually. Right there is the most essential step of all, is taking what we're interested in a more abstract or theoretical way and say, I'm going to see what it's like to put it into practice. So when it's your knee pain, it hurts more than when you're writing a midterm exam on the Buddhist theory about pleasure and pain. But that's what's real, and that's what's transformative. So it's one of the reasons I am a great, great believer in daily practice, because it's like we're making it real every day. Instead of just thinking, oh, I value presence and mindfulness, it's like, okay, here we are. It doesn't have to be that long each day. I mean, neuroscience, the last I checked, and some of you may know more than I do, the last I checked, somebody, this really very fine neuroscientist, came up to me and said that studies had shown that only 9 minutes of mindfulness a day and only 7 minutes of loving kindness a day would change your brain. And I said to him, I don't know if people should go for the bare minimum, really, you know. And I mean, I don't personally use brain changes as the measure, you know, of anything. But it doesn't seem to take endless periods. No one's saying you have to do this 6 hours a day. And it's hard to find, I say 20 minutes because that makes sense to me. If you've only got 10 minutes one day, just do 10 minutes. If you've got 3 minutes one day, do 3 minutes. The everydayness seems the most important factor, actually, more than anything. But it's the doing of it that really counts, because we're, and another one of my, kind of a great Tibetan teacher once said, the most important moment of your practice is the moment you sit down to do it. Because right in that moment, we're saying something about believing in ourselves, believing in change, putting it into practice, making it real. And then what follows will always be different. So it's not easy. I mean, that's the irony. It's like it's not a huge amount of time each day, and it's not easy. But you kind of have to do it. And it's interesting sometimes to look at why it's hard. It can be hard, certainly was for me, because I was so self-judgmental. This is when I was still living in India, and I had this pattern where, you know, if I sat down and it felt good, I felt serene and peaceful and like I was floating in the air, I think, oh good, I'm going to live in India for the entire rest of my life feeling exactly this way. And when my knee hurt or my back hurt or I was bored or I was restless, I'd get up. I think it doesn't work. It doesn't work off retreat. I'll wait till Saturday. I'll sit twice. And I finally went to my then teacher, this man named Indra, and described it, that pattern to him. And he said, for you, I just have one piece of advice. And that is just put your body there. He said, every day you just put your body there. Some days it's going to feel one way. Other days it's going to feel another way. You just have to do it. And then he didn't say this, but I would add, of course you want to assess and evaluate if it's worth continuing. But you don't want to do that every single moment because then you're never doing it, you know? So establish a time frame that makes sense to you. Is it a month? You can try it every day for a month or 2 weeks, whatever it is. And then evaluate. But when you evaluate, look at your life. Don't look at that formal 20-minute period because that's where it's really going to show. And then you'll see, do I want to continue on with this? And if you do, you have a set of tools that you're enhancing and developing that can really follow you wherever you go. So whether you do loving kindness practice or you do mindfulness practice or what proportion, it's really up to you. You know, as I said, when I sit each day, I tend to do mindfulness practice and I have a resolve to do loving kindness practice whenever I'm waiting. So that's my long trip back tomorrow, for example. On airplanes or walking down the street or just waiting in line somewhere. And it's really helpful. And then on top of that, there's short moments many times where you just see the opportunity for a moment to breathe or to offer some loving kindness silently. And it's terrific because it really starts to intersperse those activities throughout our day and the whole day starts to change. So put it into practice and see for yourself what helps you do that. Many people would say sitting with a group helps that. So is your life such that at least intermittently you can find a group? And certainly here, you know, there's a tremendous resource with this center and the community. And if not in person, then maybe online is going to be the way that it happens. You know, so check out options and see what's available and see what supports you in making it real. It seems to be quite important. And the world could use it, really, let's admit it. It seems like this is a good time to be putting some positive energy into the world. We look for that place in the middle. The non-interfering awareness means we're not pushing away, and we're also not lost in. You do it in a moment. And if it only lasts a moment, that's okay. You do it again. And that way, our whole life really has the possibility of seeming like a creative medium. It's not just painting or, you know, books or something like that, in which we create. We create in every relationship, every encounter, every time we meet a stranger, every time we drop a jar, you know, whatever it might be. There's that moment of possibility in which we can continue to manifest the things that we really do care about. Okay, any final questions or comments? Sure, so when Upandita said, it's not so much when an object becomes too intense or when it's too painful. You can move your attention to something less difficult to be with. And so how do you do that skillfully? I think it's partly a question of you develop a repertoire, you know, through your own experience. Like, I know if I sit and listen to sound, there's a certain sense of relief in the spaciousness. Or many people would say, find another place in your body, you know, that's kind of comfortable, that you can move your attention back and forth. I also know that from my own experience that when physical pain arises, not uncommonly, the whole rest of my body will kind of seize up as though to push it out. So then I'm adding stress and tension to pain. So I know when that starts to happen, if I relax and, you know, more allow the experience, that'll help. You know, so over time, it's like you really, through experience, you build up confidence in trying different things. I also wanted to say that, you know, in the, you know, I talked about the classical structure of the loving kindness practice. We didn't get to do everything. But it exists, and I also think that once you feel confident in the practice, there are lots of ways of adapting it so that your own needs are met, and it's like an experiment very often. I guess in Real Love, I also told a story about I worked on Loving Kindness, my first book. It came out in 1995, and so when I was first working on it, I didn't have a computer. I didn't have my own computer, and I hardly knew anyone who had their own computers. And one of the things I noticed about the few people I did know is that they never stopped talking about them. I thought, you know, parties anyway. I thought, what are they going on about? You know, like. But I was very, very intimidated. I thought I could never learn how to use a thing like that, you know. So in those days, I love talking about this, cutting and pasting meant getting a pair of scissors and cutting out the paragraph you were thinking of moving and moving it up and down the page until you were pretty sure where you wanted it to go. All the older people are smiling. And getting a roll of scotch tape and then taping it on the page. That's what cutting and pasting meant. So it was a slow process. And then one day, I was in Barry, it was at IMS, and we heard that we were getting a visit from this 94-year-old monk from Sri Lanka. So he came, and he was lovely, a really lovely man, monk. And we were just chatting up in one of the rooms, and he mentioned in the course of the conversation that he was learning how to use a computer. So I thought, okay. He's 94 years old. He's first learning how to use a computer. Maybe I can too. So it was one thing. So then he said, I'd like to go into the meditation hall and give a talk. So we had a retreat that was ongoing. And so I thought, okay. He's 94. It won't be a very long talk. You know, we can just gather people together and have them sit and he can speak briefly. So we did that, and it turned out to be an endless talk. It was endless, endless. He just went on and on and on and on, because he had so much energy. He had more energy than all of us put together. And somewhere in the course of the talk, he said, I want to teach you my favorite meditation. So that was kind of a, like these days we'd say it's like a combination of loving kindness and a body scan, where he moved his attention throughout his body, offering loving kindness. So it'd be like, may my head be happy. May my eyes be happy. May my ears, and he would just kind of go down. And I was sitting there thinking, wow, maybe that's why he has so much energy, you know? It's because he's just sending all this loving kindness to his body. And it's actually a very, very powerful practice and not often done, but it's what I mean by an adaptation. You know, when you have sort of the basics down, then you just see, well, what do I really need? Or what might be interesting to pursue or fun even to pursue? So that was one example. Another example, there's a place, I didn't really talk about it, but after the difficult person, before all beings, where sometimes we offer loving kindness to groups. And so they're often pairs of opposites or complementary sets, so that taken together, they form the whole of life. So that might be all those in my family, all those not in my family, something like that. So I have a friend who has had terrible insomnia, and she said something she did, which was really helpful and fun, was sometimes she'd lie in bed and she'd do loving kindness for all beings who were awake, not metaphorically but literally awake, which included her, but presumably not her neighbors. And but also included like water buffalo in India, or, you know, people going to work at the other end of the world or whatever. And somehow in those quiet hours, there was some greater sense of, you know, the connection, the energy wasn't sort of blocked by cell phones or whatever, you know, it was just. And then she'd do loving kindness for all beings who were asleep, which did not include her, but presumably included all her neighbors. And I thought that sounded like so much fun. You know, you just start to think, well, who else is awake? Well, yeah, it's, you know, like Hong Kong. You know? And I don't know that she slept better, but she got a lot of rest and joy just out of that kind of connection. So that's just another little example of, like, we adapt, you know, we kind of utilize it in different ways. And I, of course, think that getting the basics down is really helpful, so that you do have that kind of confidence. And it's another reason to really. Do you want to unstick? Do you want to unstick? Okay. So the comment was about having a lot of struggle with a very difficult person who is the president of the United States. And feeling very stuck because it's affecting her day-to-day and relationships and things that are happening. So it was interesting when I co-wrote this book with Bob Thurman called Love Your Enemies, which I did not like the title of. And we went through, like, it's the only time I've co-written a book with anybody, really. It was like 50 different iterations of titles, and this poor publisher in England designed a cover for like every title. And I went there and they just like laid out, you know. But the title just before, which I did like, was based on Bob had seen a movie. And in the movie, there was a church. And the church had, you know, as churches often have in front of them, these like little billboards, you know, with some saying. So what the church had in front of it in the movie was, love your enemies, it will drive them crazy. And that I liked. And I actually was in England when I caught wind of the fact that they were talking about taking off, it will drive them crazy. So I called the American office from the British office. I said, please don't do that. You know, I'm afraid people will feel lectured to, or they'll misunderstand, and I like, it'll drive them crazy, but in the end they took it off and I didn't have the power to stop that. But that's kind of the thing. And then I had fun with Bob as we were touring with that book, because people would say, well, you know, I don't know if I'm, you know, I feel my loving kindness is so impure, and it's so kind of calculating because I'm offering loving kindness to my boss, and they're such an asshole, and, you know, and I know if they were happier, they'd be better, and therefore the office would be better, and isn't that, like, just gross on my part because I'm so, you know, I'm so conditional in my loving kindness? And Bob would say, no, no, you're right. They would be much less of an asshole. Keep going. Of course, if they were happier, they wouldn't. So it's kind of like that. I would suggest that you actually monitor your input, because this is your life, you know, and the last thing you want is to, you know, come to the end of it whenever, hopefully a long time from now, and think, well, that was a bad decade, you know, like, it's a long time. So, you know, I would offer loving kindness to a lot of the world, you know, and ultimately everybody, but not in a way that confuses it with approval, you know, which you don't actually approve. And I always come back to action, you know, take some action. Tormenting yourself and being as overwhelmed is just going to exhaust you. And take some action, you know, go for it, whatever it might be. And you will feel better. You know, many times people think their unhappiness is selfish and it's kind of beside the point. And but let's get real, you know. It's just like being miserable is like the near enemy of compassion, is being burnt out. And it's just not going to help. It's not going to help anyone. So, you know, I say all that, and I'm the publisher called me. That's my next book. 3 years ago, I pitched a book they rejected, which he basically called me about. And I said, Bob, isn't that what you turned down 3 years ago? And he said, yeah, but it's a different world. So the book is about mindfulness, loving kindness, and social change. But it needs to be timeless in a way, you know, and not just, because I mean, that's the thing about writing anyway, it's so slow a process. And as one of my friends in tech called it, a dinosaur industry. You know, it takes like 2 years at least from the time you sign a contract before the book comes out. So the whole world's different then anyway, you know. And, but rather than, you know, being reactive or being in a kind of partisan space, I think it's more interesting to think about values like interconnection or dissolving the sense of self and other, or love. And, okay, what does that look like? Not just the cultivation of the inner state, but bringing it into a sense of community or whatever. And so, it's just ironic because it lands at a time for me. I mean, I thought, no, I'm not going to write it. And then I thought, well, how often does a publisher call you? That's never happened before, you know, and promote or, you know, proposes the exact book you wanted to write. And I said, okay, that may never happen again. I should say yes. So Tuesday night, I'm starting, literally. You know, but you have to sort of be wise about what you consume in terms of media and how and why, and decide where you want to put your energy and then put it there. And I realize that for me, you know, I have very strong commitment. I always have, you know, toward people voting. It's felt to me really honoring everyone's individual essence, like I said. And their right to have a voice. And I know it means realistically that I can't study up on every outrage that's being perpetrated and horror that's happening in the environment, and I just can't. But I'm committed where I'm committed. I did an evening with Tim Ryan in Washington, D.C. He's a congressman from Ohio who meditates. And he has a book that came out called Mindful Nation. And I'm actually supposed to be with him in New Hampshire in September, but he's always like tied to, well, if we have a vote, I can't show up, even in D.C., you know? And I was kind of thinking, I didn't think you guys were doing anything, you know? Like, what do you mean you can't show up, you know? But he showed up in D.C., and we hadn't prepared at all, like zero. And we're supposed to be talking about, this is the extent of our preparation. We met in the back of the room, we were getting mic'd. And I said, I think we should include questions. And he said, okay, you go first. That was the extent of the preparation. And we're supposed to be talking about mindfulness, but I just got on some thing about voting. And finally, he turned to me and said, are you running for office? And I said, no, but you are. You know, vote, vote, vote. You know, and we can find where our passions lie and just go there and cheer up. Bob would say, cheer up. You know, be a happy person, because otherwise it's like it's too hard. Yeah, I do, actually. Okay, so what would equanimity look like if you were in the receiving end of not only someone's malice, but like verbal attack, but real, a sense of danger, basically? Well, I mean, you always have to take care of yourself. That's like the smoke alarm, you know? You don't just stand there and think, oh, the person's yelling, you know? But internally, I think there is a quality of freedom we can get. Because, you know, there are a lot of stories other people tell about us, about each of us, and we can absorb them in some way. And we feel very affected by that kind of toxic energy, or we can have it pass through. And that's really not letting it stick. There's a story from the Buddha I'm very fond of, which I think is part of the answer of the internal process. Where the Buddha did something that really angered this farmer, like he trespassed on his land or something. And the farmer got furious, and he came up to him screaming and yelling and cursing and reviling him. And the Buddha said something like, oh farmer, what happens if you carefully prepare a gift for someone and it's in your hand and you go to hand it to them and they refuse to take it? Then the farmer said, well, then it remains with me. And the Buddha said, just so, O farmer, I'm refusing your gift of yelling and screaming and cursing and reviling. It's going to remain with you. Now, I actually use that a lot, not verbally out loud, but internally. It's like, this is yours. I'm not taking this. You know, this is going to stay with you. And it's hateful energy, you know, so that's what they're claiming, really, because I'm not picking it up. You know, in some ways, I think it's like a discharge of a very toxic state, and they would feel a relief if we did pick it up. But, so I think that's the internal exercise, you know, and process. I'm not, you know, this is yours. And, you know, there are times when, I mean, it's frightening, you know, so that's a real thing. But there are times when we might also have a sense of compassion, because what a life choice, you know. Like, the other day, I think it was the day I got here, and I was eating dinner in this restaurant attached to my hotel, and a homeless guy came in and started screaming and yelling, and you could tell everyone was very freaked out, you know, and he was freaked out. And they called somebody, I don't know who they called, you know, they got him to go outside. And it was frightening. But I also looked at him and I thought, wow, what a life, you know, like, look at that. You know, no one's meeting you at the airport, you know, and saying, I'm so glad you're here. You know, so there are ways, even in those very directed situations, where sometimes we go there and we think, wow, you live in this energy. You know, you cultivate this energy. This is your choice. you know, to sort of keep in this arena, it's kind of an amazing choice, given how big life can be. You know, it's one thing if we only thought we're capable of, like, being mediocre. But if you really believe a human being is capable of kind of greatness of heart and, you know, vision and connection, you think, wow, like, that's something. But all that also depends on a deep, deep, deep conviction that compassion doesn't mean weakness. You know, you really have to believe that in order to even want to go there. And I don't think it does mean weakness. But in terms of equanimity, it's going to look like the Buddha and that farmer, I think. I think there are also physiological reactions of fear, and we feel that. But we also don't need to solidify around it. You know, it's like that'll pass as the stimulus passes or the trigger passes. And you accept that. I mean, that's natural. You know, it's like, it wouldn't be normal to have someone scream at you and wish you were dead, you know, and think, pleasure and pain are all the same to me. You know? And it's like, I think that would be really abnormal. But with all these things, you know, it's about the relationship. As one of my teachers, Sukhna Rinpoche, would say, it's not the thought that's the problem, it's the glue. You know, it's not the reaction that's the problem, it's the glue. We hold it, and we solidify it, and we think it's forever, and, you know, what's it going to feel like tomorrow, and it's the only thing I'll ever feel, and no one else has ever felt it, and then we're stuck. I don't know. I think, you know, going back to the model that I laid out, where there's the motivation, and there's the skillfulness of speech, which is always contextual, and they're not tied together. I think from the point of view of meditative understanding, you realize this is a human being in front of you. You know, it's not an object that's in your way of having a nice day. This is a human being. And because right action or skillful action is always contextual, I don't know. It's like people say, is it right to give someone money or not when they ask you on the street? I don't know. You know, but it is right to realize this is a human being. Sometimes people will give money. Sometimes people won't give money. Sometimes I've been with friends for whom this sobriety is very important, and what they've done, you know, with me there, it's like we're like walking back from dinner, is like take that person into a deli and say, you can buy anything you want, I'll buy you any kind of food. And that's like a huge thing, because a life like that, you have very little agency. You don't say, I feel like tuna fish today, you know. And then there are people, you know, there are ways of undertaking a discipline, whether temporary or permanent, where you say, okay, I'm not going to assess where they might be using the money. I'm just going to give it. You know, and there are famous stories about, you know, a Catholic priest who was killed on 9/11 who did just that every day. Or Bob Thurman, who seems to be with me here, he undertook that in a temporary way, and it's also a way of learning about your own mind, because the whole point is that you're always paying attention to your mind and your reactions. So he decided, he was walking to Columbia University where he was teaching, and there were a lot of homeless people on the street asking for money, and he decided that for like a month or 6 weeks, his yoga, his practice, his discipline, was going to be giving everybody money. So he'd stuff his pocket with like these dollar bills, giving everybody money till it ran out. And then he talked about like one day he had made a mistake and he handed this guy a 20. And Bob watched himself freak out. Like, the guy, of course, was ecstatic. And Bob was like, can I snatch it back? You know, like, what can I do? Maybe not, you know. And so I don't know. You know, I don't know what the regulation of the place is. I don't know how much trouble she'd get in going against her boss. I don't know the condition of the bathroom. I don't know anything, you know. So that's why morality is kind of hard, because there are some guidelines, of course, but there's usually not a precise formula. You know, the best way to talk to your adolescent son who's got a drug problem is X. Like, I don't know. I wish someone knew, you know, but nobody knows, actually. And so it's a process of coming from the best motive that we can and being as present as we can and learning skills and learning from our mistakes and really being there. So there we are. Should you give money to somebody asking you on the street? Do I need a chapter on that in the book? It's getting close to Tuesday, you can tell I'm like leaning into it. People say to me, how much have you written? And I said, I signed the contract. I wrote a signature. It's the full extent of my work. Tomorrow I'm on an airplane all day, so. Tuesday I'm in a recording studio all day taping podcasts, taping five podcasts. So Tuesday night. Okay, anybody else? Could you speak a little louder? Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the question was about recent revelations about like sexual misconduct by a Buddhist. I assume you mean the Buddhist one. I suppose one of the other ones. Leader, and feeling very shaken by that. And I think that's natural. I mean, these are also complex issues, you know, where in a, you know, classical sense, the teacher-student relationship is really an extraordinary relationship. And in the best case scenario, the teacher is really motivated by the interests of the student, not by their own gratification of any kind, you know, whether it's money or sex or power or anything. And we kind of count on that, you know, as students. And I can remember even with Upandita, who was never anything like that, but he was so scary, you know, and he was so fierce, and he was so demanding, and there we were seeing him 6 days a week. And my mantra was, the teacher is there to serve me. You know, the teacher is really there to serve me. I'm not there to please him. And I think that's really the core understanding. And of course, it's excruciating when that doesn't feel like it's the case. You know, and it's also an interesting meeting of cultures. And as these different traditions come to the West, and there's a very different ethic about women and misogyny, and you know, it's different. And so it's like, here we are at the boiling point, you know, it's is really meeting with like a big clash. And I think you just have to, in a way, take refuge in yourself, take refuge in your practice. I feel like I personally have had some very potent and important teachings from very imperfect vessels. And that doesn't deny the importance of those teachings, that they were delivered onto me from somebody who I was later, you know, really disappointed in or whatever. And that's the most important thing. And how that relationship works out in the end, it's different for different people. And it, of course, depends on everyone's behavior and what happens, you know. But I feel like as old as I am, which is considerable, I've seen many iterations of this, you know, which resolve in different ways. There's Yeah, I mean, we'll see. You know, there's... it's also it's a somewhat different world because of social media and, you know, all the stuff that's out there, and some of which is all to the good, and some of which you think, really? I don't think this really happened, you know? Like, this is kind of weird. And so if you're involved or you're affected, you know, it takes a whole process to sort of really take a look at it and find your place in the midst of all that. And there's this very funny, kind of adorable, really, video that's online with Sotra Malioni, who's a woman who's a lama in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and what's her name? The lady who lives in a cave for 12 years. Tenzin Pomo, Ani Tenzin Pomo, talking about this. And they're both kind of like, especially Ani Tenzin Pomo, who's, she must be in her 70s, I think. Unless the cave really aged her a lot, you know. In which case, she's younger, but she was kind of like, ah, you know, like, who needs this? You know, like, we're doing fine. And, you know, like, it's very funny and good, you know. It's like really good advice, but you can just feel like, you know, life's hard anyway, and, you know, there are all these other things going on, and then, you know, people are getting helped, and, like, who needs this, like, on top of that? And yet it is, you know, it's happening. So I do see, I wonder how I can say this, and it'd be an all resembling right speech. I may not be able to. In talking to, I mean, I'm not really connected to that community at all, you know, but in talking to a friend of mine that is, I pointed out that in previous instances within the Tibetan Buddhist world, or some aspects of it anyway, and again, a lot of it is cultural, you know, it's a very feudal system. And in previous instances of complaints against Tibetan Buddhist teachers, there's been a pretty big wave of blaming the students for complaining. And that was a very strong reaction. You know, even just 6 months ago, the last one, you know, or a year ago, however long ago that was. And this, that didn't happen this time. So I was talking to my friend, who is very involved and really heartbroken, you know, in this other community. And I said, well, look at that. You know, that's like a big improvement. I said, I know it's a really low bar, you know, but... just think, you guys are doing better, you know, than those other guys. It is a low bar, but it's also true. It happened, you know, so, and this is different. So I think that's really, the community's to be commended, you know, in that way. Okay, so let's sit together for a few minutes. We'll do a sharing of the merit, and then we're done. So again, the idea behind... this ceremony or this practice is that when we do something towards the good, bless you, it generates a kind of positive energy. We sit, we think, we study, we're generous, we're kind, we're restrained. Like, it would be awfully easy to tell a lie and we don't. It generates this positive energy. So the first thing we do is actually allow ourselves to feel that positive energy. It's like a lot of ways of spending a weekend. You chose to come here, you chose to practice, your mind wandered, you chose to bring it back. That should bring us joy, and that's not the same thing as conceit or arrogance. It really is like delighting in goodness. And then we dedicate, we offer this positive energy, first to those who've helped us. And I'm going to sort of recite the way I do it. Feel free silently to use whatever words work for you. Just just see who comes to mind. Maybe they helped take care of things at home so you could be here. Or they helped us while here. They helped us long ago. And the words I use are something like, I dedicate the merit of my practice to you. And those whom we know are struggling, who feel alone, as an affirmation of the fact that our practice could never really be just for ourselves alone. I dedicate the merit of my practice to you, to one another as we've co-created this experience. I dedicate the merit of my practice to you. May you be, and to all beings everywhere. I dedicate the merit of my practice to all beings. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think we have some announcements. Safe travels to everybody, including me.